It is Saturday, November 29th, 2014. We are broadcasting live from Santa Cruz on the central coast of California. This is KUSP Public Radio 88.9 and KUSP.org. Ladies and gentlemen, it's time now for Geek Speak. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. Please keep in mind that the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KUSP or any of the geeks' affiliated organizations. And hello, I'm Bonnie Jean Primsch in the host chair today, joined by Ben Jaffe, who is many things, including a teacher and a world traveler and a music geek. Hello.
And a lover of rain.
And a lover of rain. We're happy to see it again. There was a bit of it last week. And
all the way down.
Yeah.
Driving in.
We still have a drought. It's not over.
Oh, yeah. No, that's true.
But it's nice to
it's important
feel like,
to remember.
Okay, maybe I'll but take 1 minute longer shower.
Are rain barrels filled up?
Oh, you have rain barrels? I'm so jealous.
Yeah.
I live in an apartment, and there's none of that sort of allowance around the property.
You could be, you know, secretive and hide them on your balcony.
I know, like a little bucket. Ben, there's lots to talk about today.
Lots and lots and lots.
And let's start with some good news, shall we? I know we can go quickly into sort of like, here's what's wrong with the world, but there's some good things.
Facebook, Apple,
yeah,
Google.
Booger.
Creative Commons. Let's talk about that.
Let's talk about that.
Because that always gives me a warm glow in my heart.
We've got a lot of gratitude for the Creative Commons. It
seems
like a good time to talk about
partially
that.
Because we are a Creative Commons work, which
That's
means
true.
You can share us any way you like. Just tell them the geeks say hi. So we're share and share alike. What is Creative Commons? Ultimately, it is a set of legalese rules that you can apply to any of your works, and know that the plain, easy to explain text generally sums it up. So if I say share and share alike, it means you can share this radio show any way you like. As long as you attribute it, that's
just
the attribution part.
Credit your source,
yeah, and the share alike part is use the same license. So
you may have to apply the same sort of go ahead and share this. So you can't lock it down once you've used it.
Yeah, there's also now there are a bunch of different kinds of Creative Commons licenses.
That's just ours. Yeah,
yeah, and you can combine all of these different pieces. There's attribution. There's share and share alike. There's non-commercial. There's all of that, and. The wonderful thing is that people actually have really taken to using this. So back in 2006, there were 50 million, roughly, Creative Commons licensed works, which seems like a big number.
Yeah, it seems big.
Today, 8 years later, we're at around 882 million estimated.
Oh, that's a nice number.
That's a lot, and that's also a conservative estimate. Now, one of the interesting things about this particular article, which is on opensource.com, is that it's difficult to measure how many licenses are Creative Commons.
Right. I mean, we don't register someplace central to declare ourselves Creative Commons, do we?
No. So I could start another podcast and I could say, this is Creative Commons. And just like that, snap of the fingers, it is, right?
Right.
I don't have to say, hey, creativecommons.org or whatever, we are using your license.
Right.
They don't even need to know about us. They just...
So without there being some sort of central reporting place, how did they come up with that number, I wonder?
Well, a lot of people will advertise the fact that they're Creative Commons by putting the Creative Commons images up there.
Ah, yes.
And so what they did is they looked at the number of people who are hotlinking to their served images. So how many people are linking to their images? And then also they asked Google, hey, Google, how many places are using this image? And Google,
provided some
results. Uh-huh. And again, they're very conservative by nature. But the 882 million number means they're likely approaching or maybe have passed a billion Creative Commons works, which is phenomenal.
That's great. I wonder how that compares to the total number of things.
The total number of things in the world.
When there are almost a billion Creative Commons things.
Are you talking about subatomic particles in the universe? Or are you talking about things?
Things that are made.
That are made, yeah. Yeah, that would be really interesting to know. Now, a couple other interesting things about this is of the Creative Commons license uses that they saw, they saw that a really large percentage of it, over 50%, allow commercial use, which is kind of cool.
Oh. So that they are likely to spread far.
They're more likely to spread far.
Yeah.
So let's say I take a picture of a hummingbird outside my window and I share that with commercial use disabled, that means that anyone can reuse it and, you know, using the license. But
they can't make a dollar on it.
Exactly. They can't make a dollar on it. But I love the idea that people are just like, yeah, I made this. Share it.
Yeah.
You know, use it. It's free. It's Creative Commons, right?
That's life as we like to think it's possible to be lived.
Mm-hmm. And then the other stat is 76%. That's 3/4 allow adaptations, which means you can take my picture of a hummingbird and you can,
remix
you know,
it.
Remix it. put it in the desert. I don't know. I don't know what you're going to do with the hummingbird. But it's kind of amazing. And then also the free culture licensee part of it has actually been going up. People are being more liberal and open in the way that they use Creative Commons licenses as time goes on.
That's really good. You know, I hope there's some sort of continued analysis of how the Creative Commons is doing as compared to more traditional copyright.
Yeah.
You know, as we go forward, and certainly there's more sort of corporate interest in locking things down and being the controller of what happens.
Yeah, that's true.
How effective is 1 billion strong at providing a healthy alternative to that?
The really cool thing about Creative Commons, the thing that I love the most about it, is I don't have to be a lawyer to understand what I'm doing legally, right? I can just use these.
It's fairly straightforward.
These art, yeah, it's phenomenal. It's wonderful. It's empowering.
It's empowering.
As a content creator.
Yes, yes. It means that lawyers can focus their time on other things.
Yes. It's good for the lawyers, too.
Yes. You know, last week we talked extensively about Twine being a gaming platform that made it possible to explore kind of social issues and psychological issues.
Yeah, there was the game about depression.
About depression, and there's other kinds that are out there. Howling Wolves, I believe, is one that, or Howling Dogs, I think, is one that was profiled in the New York Times article that I linked to last week.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, that's of interest to me, is how people are using technology to provide a chance at empathy. At other people experiencing what a minority of people experience. And now there's another thing that's come along using Raspberry Pi.
Which is a little piece of hardware that you can program.
It's this adorable little computer. It's very simple and can be used for a lot of things. And so there's a group called Analog that has developed an interactive installation that they're calling Transports. Now, as far as I know, this has like a virtual reality element in that you wear a glove.
Okay, so you sit down, you put on this glove.
You wear a glove, and then you...
And then they're also providing stimulus to your eyes, like you put on some goggles or something, right?
Yeah, there's like a point-of-view video. It's not clear to me if it's in an Oculus Rift-type setup. But you're watching a point-of-view video that shows a hand, and you're wearing a glove on the analogous hand on yourself. And as you're watching the hand move in the video, the glove is providing tremors like a person with Parkinson's experiences.
Oh, wow.
And then you're made to like, okay, pick up a spoon. And then you can see how non-straightforward it is
you
as a person with Parkinson's to pick up a
feel.
Spoon. And feel.
That's really interesting.
Yeah. And so it's an encouraging use, first of all, of some simple computing, of like a virtual reality type element. And I really hope that more programs like this are developed so people can really have the experience of what their loved ones are experiencing or, you know, to be able to get inside the experience.
Well, empathy
of someone
is
with
important.
A disease or a, it is.
Empathy is so important.
In compassion, in creating technologies that can help a person navigate who has a particular condition. I can see it being useful for a lot of different stuff.
Yeah, I mean, so as a web developer, often I struggle with that because I am not visually impaired. I don't have color blindness as a small thing, and I'm not blind. So when I have to put accessibility tags on HTML elements so that way people who are visually impaired can navigate my website, it's so easy as someone who is not impaired in that way to forget about that entirely. And, you know, even if I don't forget, it's sometimes difficult to have that empathy as well, because it can be difficult to go in and put in the extra amount of time to make it accessible.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly. So I have a lot of hope that things like, what's it called? The thing from Analog.
The thing.
Transports.
Transports.
I don't know why they called it Transports. It's so interesting. that things like that, like Zoe Quinn's depression game, mm-hmm. Will help people kind of understand and then develop tools to help make lives better for those that are undergoing those kind of conditions and diseases and so on.
I like this story.
I like it too.
This gives me hope.
It does. Which I guess we could make just like a blatant play or request. If anyone out there is developing similar sorts of things, we want to know about it.
We do.
We think they're worthy of coverage and we would like to help cover them.
Yeah.
So if you have any things in development that help provide empathy for groups that have a hard time accessing other people's empathy, please let us know at geeks@geekspeak.org.
Oh, I'm getting warm, fuzzy feelings just knowing that we might get a flurry of email.
You know, even just one or two would be great.
Even just one.
So if you're that,
be that
person,
one.
Yeah.
Light up our lives.
Light up our lives by letting us know you're doing something great for everybody.
Oh, that's great.
Because we're in. We get it. Let's say someone develops something like that or some other, come up with a study and they want to publish it.
Okay, yeah. So
what's the experience of getting into...
So, talking about scientific papers,
yeah.
If you write a scientific paper, there's this process. Different journals will often accept your paper, and then you can pay a fee to get it published. I mean, often if you write a scientific paper and you're not getting anyone publishing it, and then someone emails you and says, "Hey, this is a great paper. I'd love to publish it. Mm-hmm. It's $100." You know, send us $100, we'll publish your paper in a reputable sounding journal. There's your first hint that this is not going well.
Dun, dun, dun.
Well, it turns out there are a lot of scams. For example, the International Journal of Advanced Computer Technology. Sounds reputable, right?
International Journal of
Advanced Computer Technology.
Okay.
So here's what happened in this story. Sometimes people will make goofy or kind of joking papers, right?
Yeah.
And try to get them accepted. And ideally...
It's like a prank.
Yeah. So if there were no scams, then there would be humans reviewing all of these papers and saying like, yeah, that's obviously a joke, so we're going to throw it out, right?
Yeah.
And there have been tons of examples in the past of kind of nonsense papers making it through. They sound all eloquent and
science-y. There's been a rash of that lately, right?
Yeah. Well, this particular paper is entitled... Get Me Off Your Effing Mailing List. And it's...
That's the name of the paper?
That's the name of the paper.
Okay.
And the actual paper literally just contains that phrase over and over and over again.
Oh, like the chalkboard admonishment.
Right. Yeah. And then has a nice flow chart and scatter plot, both of which spell out. So
clearly just kind of like a big raspberry.
There is no way a human could look at this and think, This is a legit paper, right?
Yeah.
So this actual paper got accepted by the International Journal of Advanced Computer Technology.
Does that mean that it was published? What does that mean?
No, it got accepted for a fee. So they pre-accepted this paper. They said, this paper is great. They actually, you know, wrote them an email and said, this is a great paper. An anonymous reviewer rating it as, quote, excellent. And the requested fee is $150 for publication.
Oh, this is like learn to draw Tippy, send us money to join the art school.
Right. So these are predatory journals. And the number of these journals has increased staggeringly.
Okay.
Increased.
So that's why it's a scam and just not like a bad bit of process.
Yeah, this is a clear scam.
Okay.
I mean, so there are... There's actually a up-to-date list of scam journals. And if you write scientific papers and you want to avoid these people, you can look at this particular up-to-date list. Jeffrey Beal, he's a librarian at the University of Colorado. He keeps an up-to-date list, and currently it has 550 publishers and journals. 550 is a big number.
That's big number, yeah.
It's a lot
that
of scam
journals.
That gives
me a frowny face.
Yeah, you actually do.
I have a frowny face right now.
But I don't know. I love that that was the title of the paper, and somehow it got through still.
I mean, it's a good test, right?
That's
a pretty effective test.
Easy test.
If someone's a legit journal or not. Okay. All right. So we're going to have a link to that list, right, at our website.
The test could be, can you read the title in full on the air?
Yes.
If you can't read down the air, probably not.
Probably not. Although sometimes perfectly legitimate papers have colorful titles.
I guess you're right.
I mean, you have to get someone to read them after you write them, right?
Yeah, that's true. that's a good point. That's a very good point.
Yeah. All right. So we'll put up at geekspeak.org
that's
link to
site.
That list
mm-hmm.
of bogus journals.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Listen, when we come back, we'll talk more about the commercial side of things happening in Geeklandia. You're listening to Geekspeak here on KUSP. Another great show on KUSP is the 7th Avenue Project. This week on the show, Michael Robbins is hardly the first poet to mix high and low culture in his verse, but few have pulled it off so seamlessly, matching up Led Zeppelin and Wallace Stevens, Jay-Z and Robert Lowell, video games and Shakespeare, without favoritism or condescension. Michael Robbins talks to KUSP's Robert Pauly about his latest poetry collection, The Second Sex. It's a follow-up to his wildly acclaimed debut volume, Alien vs. Predator. You'll hear about it on the 7th Avenue Project, Thinking Persons Radio with Robert Pauly, tomorrow at noon on KUSP. And keep in mind, you can also check out, and please do, his website at 7thAvenueProject.com. That's number 7thAvenueProject.com. Right now, you're listening to Geek Speak on KUSP. I'm Bonnie Jean Primsch in the host chair, and with me in the air room is Ben Jaffe. And we want to talk about the commercial side of things, which to me, let's go straight to Disney.
Sure.
All right.
Why not?
Yeah.
So, actually, I'm going to talk about the Hour of Code, and then I'll talk about Disney, because they do link directly in this article. The 2014 Hour of Code. The idea is to get as many people around the world mm-hmm. to write at least a couple lines of code.
Right. And we talked about this last year, and mm-hmm. there was some attempt to get me to join the Hour of Code, and I have refused so far.
Oh, no.
Just mostly for lazy reasons.
Will you do it in 2014?
Maybe. No.
Maybe. We can't get you to say yes this time. You made that mistake once.
Yes. Yeah. This time I'll just be more realistic about expectations.
Yeah. So the idea is to get people to code. Mm-hmm. And this is men, women, boys, girls, mm-hmm. anybody,
people.
Everybody,
yeah.
people, right? And, of course, there has been kind of an issue around computers and computery things being marketed primarily to the males of mm-hmm. our society in the past. So,
and some of them have made the mistake of thinking that it's theirs, all theirs, and no one should be allowed in the club.
Yeah, and that is a different story, but definitely important.
Yeah.
So there have been a lot of attempts these days to get women to be writing software mm-hmm. and to be engaging in that space, and I think that's fantastic. So where does Disney come in? Well, Disney is actually going to be involved in this year's Hour of Code. They are featuring the two princesses, the princesses from Frozen, and Anna and Elsa. They're featured in the signature tutorial of C-Ed Week's 2014 Hour of Code. And my first response is, that's kind of cool. That's going to get a lot of people who are...
So the characters show up to help explain what the Hour of Code is?
Yeah.
Is
that... And write some software themselves, actually.
Oh.
Some basic code themselves.
What? Oh, like in the tutorial, they're writing code and showing you how to do it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. And so did Disney help produce the video this year? Is that the idea?
Yeah. Well, Disney has been very involved. Uh-huh. And I think my first reaction is, this is wonderful, because it's going to get every young girl I've interacted with over the last, I don't know how many months, knows the song from Frozen.
Yeah, well, people. I mean, just in general,
people.
But also the princesses from Frozen, those costumes were flying off the shelves this Halloween. There's mm-hmm. there's an element of wanting to see Frozen again and again and again among girls of a certain age.
And my partner teaches voice lessons, and she finds that everybody wants to sing that song.
Aha!
Again and again and again. So this
In fact,
is...
it was one song from Frozen was sung at Lyle's wedding.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. It's pervasive.
It really is everywhere. Mm-hmm. So I love the idea that Frozen will be involved in programming and make it cool, I guess, for those kinds of people. At the same time...
Yeah, I hear an ellipsis. What's
the
butt?
At the same time, it's... Disney's marketing department must be really, really happy right now, you know? Like,
oh, because the product placement.
It's huge product placement,
mm-hmm.
right?
It's now, social good washing.
Yeah, so there's that element of it, and that's not to be downplayed. At the same time, Disney is also donating $100,000 to code.org to support this process. Mm-hmm. So
it's not really just washing. They're actually doing something.
Yeah, it's one step towards a more dystopian future, I suppose.
Yeah, hold on, how do you put that together?
Where you can buy product placement in educational materials. Now, I mean, you already can do that in various situations.
Mobile has already sponsored so many public television shows. I mean, it's been an ongoing kind of queasiness, I think, that's in this sort of do-good sector.
I guess the point I'm trying to make is it's complicated, right?
Yeah,
it's complicated.
We're seeing it here, too, on a kind of a big scale.
It's a big scale. Yeah. It's Disney and it's Code.org, and that's both big scales.
They're good things.
But I don't know. Do the ends justify the means? I'm pretty excited at the idea of how many kids who watch Frozen, who are really excited about Frozen, will do this and write an hour or more of code and maybe go on to become software engineers, or at least having an understanding of that space, a better understanding of that space, and maybe even playing in it.
I suppose we should check out the tutorial and see how the princesses from Frozen conduct themselves while they're showing how to code.
It's better than the story from last week.
Yes, I'm a little concerned that it might get Barbied.
It's not a Barbie thing, no.
Okay, good. Good. Oh, what are we linking to about this on our website? Is there going to be a link to the tutorial, perhaps?
I actually found this particular story on Slashdot. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to link to that story because it's got, I don't know, 8-10 links.
Okay,
in
so
this
you might be able to.
Text.
Okay, good. So hopefully you can get around and explore what this means.
Yeah, hop onto geekspeak.org, click through to Slashdot. You'll have a plethora of links.
And just a shout out to the website. We have done a fairly thorough job of putting up links to all of the stories that we talk about over the years, because we do believe that it's not enough just to hear the geeks sort of narrate what's been happening or summarize what's been happening, but to be able to explore for yourself and satisfy your own curiosity. So as you're listening to the show, we do encourage you to go to geekspeak.org and, you know, read up a little bit more on what it is you're hearing about. We post all the articles as soon as we broadcast the show. So do check in periodically with geekspeak.org.
And we have a lot of previous shows up there, too.
Yeah, so, back to 2006. Someone asked us about that earlier.
How can I
hear more GeekSpeak?
8 years.
That's a long time.
How many hours is that? That's a lot.
Don't think about it.
400 hours?
Yeah, something.
Now I got to check my math in my head.
Someone do math.
Anyway.
All right.
Oh, you could listen to a lot of us.
A lot of us.
Like way more than you want.
Yeah. I'm wondering how many of those episodes we've talked about Star Wars.
You know, I was talking with Lyle the other day, and he's like, it's really interesting to listen back to some of the really old episodes, because the show has definitely changed a lot. Mm-hmm. And also, like, there will be an episode where, what is USB? Like,
USB
ports. I mean, they're everywhere now. Every single computer has a USB port. It's kind of amazing that there was an episode of GeekSpeak where we had to explain what USB ports were.
There's like a whole genre of looking back at how technological products were introduced to the mainstream audience, you know, like the little clips of Barbara Walter interviews and stuff like that. Let's say you don't have time to watch the show and you want to watch it later. What do? Well, you put this VHS in this video cassette recording. How does it work?
Adorable. Can we just do a whole show of you doing Barbara Walters?
No.
Okay.
We will spare everyone.
I'll just have to live with that bit. Oh, yeah. Hey, speaking of Disney.
Yeah.
Star Wars Episode 7, the trailer has been released for those of you who are very excited about that.
Okay.
I'm not super excited about that. I'm a Star Trek person.
Oh, you're more of a Star Trek guy.
I am more of a Star Trek person.
Are you a little disappointed in Abrams' allegiances?
Too many lens flares for me.
Me too, yeah.
I don't know. There's something great about lens flares. They really, really look beautiful, but...
Judiciously applied.
They don't belong in Star Trek.
Yeah, okay.
Not like that.
But do they belong in Star Wars? Maybe he'll be more at home in the Star Wars universe.
You know, I'm very curious how that'll be.
Yeah.
Are they gonna do it more in the style that they did it back in the day when...
I think Abrams gonna Abrams.
Uh-huh. Abrams will Abrams what Abrams Abrams
Yeah, exactly.
Says.
Yeah. So why are we talking about this trailer?
Oh, I just wanted to point out for any of you Star Wars geeks who want to go look at it, the first trailer, the very first trailer, the first footage we will ever see of this movie has been released on YouTube. It's got 15 quintillion views already.
Gee, it must be like a really groundbreaking piece of film or something.
Not to me. I don't know.
No?
It just seems like a movie trailer to me. But
so nothing new. Nothing, cinematically, nothing new.
Nothing too new. But hey, you know,
right.
19,500,000 people so far. So hey, you could be number 20 million.
Squeal. Well, all right, there it is. We are not total fanboys of the Star Wars universe. Yeah,
it's worth checking out,
but
if you are,
though. It's worth checking out if you're wanting to keep up on that kind of thing. More products, I insist. Let's talk about more products.
Yeah, if you if by chance you wanted to watch this this trailer on, say, external monitor, there is a square monitor you could watch it on. Like,
now, the parts of this story confuse me, because there's been such a pull toward widescreen as being kind of the viewing experience for movies and stuff like mm-hmm. that. And I have a wider screen, although the amount of scrolling I have to do on my laptop is annoying.
Yeah, so that's actually what this monitor is maybe trying to address. It is the FlexScan EV2730Q, which is okay. Such a mouthful. It's, I don't know.
I can't repeat it.
They're not going to win any naming contests.
It needs a new name. All right.
By, I think it's EIZO, E-I-Z-O. I don't know.
EIZO, sure.
Anyway, it's kind of a cool looking monitor. I think mainly it's cool looking to me because, I mean.
Square is a pleasing shape.
Well, have you ever seen a square monitor? Like if
I kind of feel
back,
like maybe some of the back of the early ones, you know, like Lappy 3000 or whatever was a.
It might have been.
Or some of those, the early Apples, weren't they kind of like
but
a square
monitor?
But
for the most part, the most square you get is 4:3 aspect ratio. So 4 across and 3 down units, whatever you want to use. And now we're 16:9, you know, that's great for theatrical, for watching movies, basically.
Well, wait a minute, you're a web developer.
Yes.
Aren't you annoyed at the thought that a square screen might take hold and therefore you have to redesign all your stuff to fit in that aspect ratio?
Not really, because really with web development, you're mainly just dealing with the horizontal space. But I can tell you I'm a little bit excited because with screens getting wider and wider and wider, I've started buying screens that I can rotate 90 degrees. So they are super, super tall and super, super skinny.
Okay.
And then I can take all of the code that I'm writing and I can full screen it and read a lot more code, because really it's about how much vertical space you have when you're reading code, when you're reading articles, when you're writing documents. So this monitor is, aside from being kind of unusually tall looking to our, you know, eyes, it is good for that. So anyway, I don't know. I mean, I'm not saying go out and buy it.
The prototype thing, is this on the market?
You can go buy it. I'm not saying go buy it. I'm just saying it looks weird, and I think it's funny looking. That's really what I'm saying.
You're just pointing and laughing.
I'm just kind of pointing and laughing.
Okay. That silly square monitor, I'll join you.
I don't know. We'll see. But I am excited to see at least one company going the opposite direction rather than making them wider and shorter. So
Well, good.
We'll see.
Also in product news, apparently there's been a little bit of buzz from a company called Fashion Entertainments.
Fashion? I've never heard of them.
It's an awfully generic name. It turns out it's actually Sony trying to get some kind of crowdsourcing type buzz for a watch that uses e-ink.
So Sony made a fake company to be not Sony, to be maybe cooler than Sony. And
it's like writing under
buzz.
A pen name, you know, so you could try out a type of writing that's not your usual or something.
Yeah.
So apparently it got enough interest, or they needed to create more buzz, that they revealed themselves at Sony as being behind Fashion Entertainments. And the idea is that the watch itself uses e-ink, so instead of there being a hand that goes around, it sort of like reprints on the page. It's got that neat matte look. You can also change the look of your wrist band. That's also e-ink.
So it's not just the watch face. Like
it's
all
not
of the
just
watches
the watch
that have been coming out are all just the watch face, but this is all the way around the band.
Yes, and the idea is the fashion accessory can be changed. And so I think they're hoping to get kind of like an e-ink of things going.
An e-ink of things.
Of thing, like instead of an internet of things, an e-ink of things.
Oh, that
like more
internet.
Things that have used e-ink as part of their lookability.
The internet of things, that phrase, I'm so tired of hearing phrase.
Is it over already?
Yeah.
We haven't even really gotten our internet of things and you're already tired of the phrase.
Well, so I'm tired of the phrase because I've heard it so many times.
Mm-hmm.
But also because an internet of things, it's misleading. It's not a separate internet of things and then the internet of computers.
It's all one internet.
It's a bunch of things which are now on the internet.
Yeah, that's all it is.
So why are we calling it an internet of things?
Because we're just so thrilled at the idea that our refrigerator can play music for us and tell us about the weather.
Yeah.
It's Geek Speak here on KUSP. I'm Bonnie Jean Primsch in the air room with Ben Jaffe, and we were just talking about the overused phrase, internet of things.
Ah, yes, the Internet of Things. So the idea behind the Internet of Things is you've got a bunch of things that aren't necessarily computers, but maybe a wristwatch or a quadcopter or, a refrigerator.
Right.
All of these things that normally wouldn't be computer-y becoming more computer-y and also connecting to the
more internet. More internet-y.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you don't have to update the time on your clock if it connects to the internet and figures out what the real time is.
Yeah. And and also consider, let's say, if your phone and your lights and your refrigerator and all of these different things, maybe your hot water heater, like the one for making tea, if they all knew all the things that the others knew, and they also knew what your smartphone knew. Hey, Ben's about to get home. We better put on some water for tea, you know? Like,
you can set up those kind of automatic systems in a way.
The refrigerator can say, oh, Ben's at the store. Buzz his phone.
Remind
tell him to
that
buy.
He needs horseradish. Or
buy the milk, right?
Yeah. No.
It's like, how much money do we need to spend before our refrigerator will remind us to buy milk? It seems like that's
shopping
always been...
Shopping lists are hard.
That's, that's always been the example, right?
Right.
For the last 15 years.
Yeah.
So anyway, this is a really interesting story that is talking about what security experts feel about...
Now, where did you see this story?
The Internet of Things. This one I also found on Slashdot.
On Slashdot, okay.
But it links out. And security experts tend to think of the world a little bit differently than most people.
Well, it's like if you're a cop for a long time and you encounter a certain segment of the population that is likely to encounter cops a lot of the time, then they start to form a view of the world that's based on that rather than the total context of humanity.
And security experts are somewhat similar. I mean, like, for example, someone was telling me... a security friend of mine was telling me, when I go to the grocery store, I don't just do my shopping and then check out and leave. I'm constantly thinking, how would I steal this? How would I be able to steal that? What security systems would stop me? How likely would it be that I could get it out, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it's this different way of thinking about the world. And you don't have any intention of robbing a convenience store or a grocery store or anything.
It's just the filter, the sort of like constant sort of puzzle filter that's running.
And that is exactly what you need to be a security expert. You know, how would I break into this computer and steal all the passwords if I were to do that, right?
Oh, and so when we're talking about the Internet of Things...
Now we're talking not just stealing passwords. We're talking about actually manipulating reality to a much... bigger, a much larger extent. So, for example, how would I hack into Ben's fridge and just turn it off? And then all of his, I don't know, milk would spoil. And then he'd always be going to the store to get milk. No, I don't know. Those kinds of things, right? Now, that's a pretty innocuous example.
Sure.
What about how do I turn off this person's insulin pump?
Remotely.
Right, remotely.
Ooh, that's spookier. Okay.
Or make it go way more than it should be going, right?
So on Slashdot, there's an article about what security experts proposing ways to kill people using the Internet of Things.
not exactly. Not exactly.
What the heck?
But proposing that the Internet of Things will at some point be used to kill people. Now,
that is a very specific view on the world, I have to say.
I don't know. I mean, so the thing that I have trouble with that sentence is that the Internet of Things is not a thing so much as it is...
The Internet of Things doesn't kill people. Security know-it-all people who know how to abuse the Internet of Things kill people.
Right, but the Internet of Things isn't even an Internet of Things. It's just the way our world currently is.
Yeah.
As opposed to a thing that our world is becoming, I guess. Or I don't know. I'm not explaining this super well, but...
You take issue... It's back to your chafing about the term.
I guess I just don't like... Yeah, I don't like the term because it's misleading. It's almost like... I'm not doing the best job of explaining, I guess, my issue with it. But I guess a better way to put it would be the way the world is going, soon things that were not internet-connected devices mm-hmm. will be used to do things like kill people. Like, for example, quadcopters or drones, you know? Like, mm-hmm. they're saying, like, imagine that they're equipped with explosives and controlled by terrorists, you know? Like, it's just another tool in the tool belt of somebody who's being malicious to wreak havoc on the world.
Now, right now, people who are prone to worrying are realizing that they're going to have to worry about just their appliances not just the usual panoply of things to worry about.
So it's difficult because this also can become fear-mongering.
Yeah.
Very, very quickly.
Well, I get really curious when people publish articles like that, you know, ahead of a reality really taking hold.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we're sort of headed there, certainly, but that reality hasn't really taken hold where everyone's stuff is connected to everything. But when
we're getting there.
When you write an article and publish it saying, hey, watch out, because, I mean, it's like local TV news, you know?
Well,
what's in your refrigerator that could kill you? Stay tuned.
Yeah, yeah. Well, to be clear, these are people writing articles about what security analysts are saying.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think this is security experts saying, hey, everybody, just so you know.
Watch out, everyone.
You know, your furnace will start a fire and kill everybody. No, it's not so much that.
I get sort of curious about what it is people choose. I mean, I guess it's just trying to get clicks.
Well,
really, ultimately, it's about...
But that's the journalists trying to get clicks.
The journalists
try to get
clicks.
Not the security experts.
Yeah.
The security experts write
things
in papers.
They're just doing their research. And,
yeah, and they share their research and their papers and everything. And if there is a security exploit, which is really serious, which could really cause a lot of damage, then what they tend to do is, rather than share it right away, they will disclose it to the people who need to fix the bug first. And then, you know, give the software manufacturers or whatever it is a chance to fix the bug before they say, hey, everybody.
The sky's falling.
You can hack it. You can, I don't know, whatever.
Yeah. Okay. So they're doing their job just fine.
They're telling
me that I shouldn't be concerned about security experts.
See,
walking
that's
early.
The security experts, that is their job, is to think of things and is from a security standpoint and then, you know, share that information.
Yeah.
Without them... Then we'd have malicious people doing all of this and nobody would even, you know, necessarily be aware of it.
That's true.
Their
or
job
we'd
is
be behind
kind of,
the curve and their job is to stay ahead of the curve.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
It's the old cat and mouse game.
It's just difficult. And I guess this is a fuzzy line for journalists, too. Like,
yeah. What do you cover? What don't you cover?
Yeah. What do you cover this topic just naively like that, and you say, you know, hey,
they said this was going on, so I just thought you guys should know.
Bad news, everyone.
Yeah.
or do you not cover it, or do you try to cover it in a more context aware way, like at least I'm trying to do right now?
Yeah. I mean, in a way, it kind of gets to the old scientific argument too. Like, well, I'm creating this new technology.
Mm.
And, you know, I'm just creating this thing. Do I have to think about how it might be used and design into it some features that make it harder to use for nefarious purposes?
Yeah. I guess you could stifle scientific progress.
That's the concern, right?
Or I guess what you're saying more specifically here is in developing something, you can try to build in safeguards. Like Isaac Asimov's laws of robotics, where a robot cannot harm a human being and a robot
mm-hmm.
cannot do this and must put the humans before itself and everything.
Yeah.
Although that's a very idealistic, contrived situation with Asimov's laws of robotics. Very often you can't do that.
Yeah, but as a Star Trek-based show, Geek Speak, We want to think that the Federation is possible, right? That people will come together and kind of get their heads out of their tukuses and think of the larger whole.
Yeah, work together as
and proceed as,
one.
As a society with the larger whole in mind. And, you know, every day we see examples where that fails to happen and we get discouraged. And then we see Raspberry Pi being used to help people have Parkinson's disease empathy, and maybe there's some hope.
Yeah.
And I don't know how those things balance.
Neither do I.
No.
That's difficult. Ooh, this is turning into a philosophical conversation.
Getting deep here on Geek Speak today. Speaking about...
I just have to say, maybe we should have covered the positive stories at the end.
I always make that mistake. I want to cover the good news, but then I often need a good news chaser.
I've only got bad news.
Oh, no. What's next?
Oh, boy. What's next? We're going to briefly talk a little bit about China. So China just – now here's the headline of the article is China just blocked thousands of websites.
And this is an article on
– censorship, I suppose.
Okay.
Uh-huh. But it's a little bit more complicated than that, as it usually is with headlines.
Yeah.
So to take – I guess we'll just take a step back and talk a little bit how the internet works.
Okay.
So let's say that I build a website.
All right.
And you visit my website.
All right.
And let's say that you are in France and my website is in a server just down the road from me in San Jose.
Okay.
All right.
Yeah.
So every request that your computer makes to my server saying benjaffe.com, or I don't own that sadly, but benjaffe.org.
Yeah.
Every request you make, whether it's for the web page itself or images or huge videos or any of that stuff,
mm-hmm.
it goes all the way from France over to San Jose,
yeah.
several steps along the way,
yeah.
and then it goes all the way back.
And then all the content is on that one server. And so mm-hmm. if there's a bunch of me in France looking at your website, it can be a load on your server.
Yeah. If I get popular in France, that may be bad. And also, all of you guys visiting my webpage, you have to wait.
Mm-hmm. Mon Dieu.
So let's say that I have content that I know is going to be big. Let's say mm-hmm. I have a big website. A lot of people visit. Mm-hmm. Let's say I own Apple.com or Google.com or okay. I don't know, maybe something a bit smaller than that. But mm-hmm. the idea is I can, instead of putting my website on one server or one server cluster in San Jose, I can distribute it around the world. Now, okay. if I am Apple or Google, I can afford to own a lot of servers all around the world. But if, let's say, I don't have that much money, instead what I can do is I can use what's called a CDN, or a content delivery network.
Content delivery network. So this is where you can put a collection of things like big videos and pictures and articles mm-hmm. that can be used by several websites, or that are
mainly
just easier for people to access in
well,
some
it
way?
Could be used by several websites, mm-hmm. as with Google hosting jQuery. Tons and tons of websites use jQuery, and they all host it from Google's CDN. But in my little contrived example, I'm just basically putting copies of the large assets of my website all across the world.
Okay.
Now, they're not on benjaffe.org anymore. Let's say they are on edgecastcdn.net/gobbledygook/gobbledygook, right?
Yeah.
And that's the web address for the video I'm serving all uh-huh. around the world.
And then another piece could be on some other...
Some other URL on the yeah. same CDN or something.
Yeah.
But the point is that all of these CDNs, like edgecastcdn.net as an example, they've got servers all around the world, and their job is to host your content all around the world so that way nobody has to go very far
mm-hmm.
to get to your content.
Yeah.
So that's all well and good.
It makes for better traffic across the globe.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Absolutely. Now, China is currently in the business of censoring the web.
Yeah, we've heard about that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Quite a bit.
Now, usually, what does that mean?
Well, let's say they don't like me.
Okay.
Right? So what they do is they
Ben
have...
Jaffe, I have to tell you, China doesn't like you.
They poison the DNS entry for benjaffe.org. And all of a sudden now, the people in China, when they go to benjaffe.org, the DNS resolution doesn't work out, and then they can't find benjaffe.org, so they can't get to my server in San Jose.
Tell me again what DNS means.
DNS, domain name server, it's basically the way you convert something like benjaffe.org into the actual address of my server.
Okay. Right.
172.87.25.5
yeah.
or something.
Okay.
once you have that address, then you know where to go, and then your traffic can be routed properly.
So they can snip it at that level so that people could type in your address, but they wouldn't get to you.
It's basically like burning the phone book, right? All of a sudden, you know who you want to reach. Mm-hmm. You know what their name is, but you can't connect to them because you don't have the lookup table, that you don't have the
digits.
Way of... Exactly.
Yeah. Okay.
So let's say that they don't resolve benjaffe.org properly. They've effectively blocked my website.
Mm-hmm.
But let's say that I start hosting all of my content, the content that they want to censor.
On one of these networks.
Let's say on edgecastcdn.net. Well, okay. What China recently did in quote-unquote blocking thousands of websites, what they did is they blocked edgecastcdn.net, which is one of the CDNs, which is used for serving content that they don't necessarily want the people in China to see.
Okay, so that's
they blocked the CDN, which
means... So they figured out how to block a CDN.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's pretty easy to block a CDN.
Or they just thought to do it.
The problem is that it's not just me, their political enemy.
There's a bunch of other stuff that they've cut off at the knees, too,
so
that they might not
host,
object to.
You host your stuff on the CDN.
Yeah.
My friend hosts his stuff on the CDN.
Mm-hmm.
Some big, awesome, you know, China-friendly...
Friend
of China hosts their stuff on the CDN. So basically what they did is they broke a whole bunch of websites, because now you might be able to get to my homepage,
mm-hmm.
but you can't load the content from my homepage.
Right.
Or
so,
you know.
Is this an example of China cutting off their nose to spite their face?
Yeah, maybe. I've never heard that saying before. I had to parse that.
Oh, okay, yeah. So that's a saying. Oh boy, you really cut off her nose to spite his face, and of course now his face is out of nose.
Yeah.
It's not just about objecting to the nose. You've messed up the whole face now.
Well, here are some examples of places that are now blocked and messed up.
Okay.
Sony Mobile.
Whoops.
The Atlantic.
Oops.
Drupal.org. Firefox's addons.cdn.mozilla.net. That's blocked, so you can't get add-ons for Firefox, which I don't know. Maybe China's happy about that one. Gravatar. So if you have my email address...
Mm-hmm.
Gravatar runs a service that will associate an image with my email address. So that way you can take that email address that you have of mine,
mm-hmm.
and you can get a picture and then associate it on a website and have a nice, pretty little picture mm-hmm. to put next to my email address and everyone else's.
Right.
So these are all services that are quite disrupted right now because China blocked a large CDN.
My guess is that China experienced a moment of triumph and then started receiving complaints.
Oh, yeah. Oh, I'm sure. So I'm hoping that they backpedal on this pretty quickly because it's kind of messed up.
Yeah. Yeah. All right.
They're breaking the internet.
Yeah. They're breaking the whole internet now.
Mm.
It's not just about China stuff, right? Doesn't that affect what people can reach throughout the world or just?
No, it's just within
it's China. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Those poor Chinese.
Yuck.
Boo.
Anyway.
All right. Let's talk about.
But it's raining. So,
it is raining. Yay.
Good news.
I think we've got time for one more story.
All right, let's do
Ben.
It.
Do you want to talk about internet culture? Do you want to talk about who names the bugs?
Who names the bugs?
Okay.
It's a fairly short story. It's actually a good story. My coverage of it will be fairly short.
Okay.
But Heartbleed, the Heartbleed bug. Do you remember that?
Mm-hmm.
So as it turns out, there's actually people who name those things, right?
Yeah, who names it?
Yeah,
just figured it was some sort of journalist.
It's a name for a security vulnerability. So a security vulnerability is there. People discover it. How did it get such a fancy, pretty icon?
Perpetrators give it the name?
And a website. No. Like
Black Bart.
It was kind of like almost a marketing agency kind of thing, you know? It was basically some people decided this is a really big bug. We need people to know about it so that way it will be patched quickly. And so they made a logo, they made a website, they wrote out a bunch of explanations that are relatively easy to understand.
So it's people who wanted to stop the bug, not those who wanted to propagate the bug.
Exactly.
Interesting.
And then there's the shell shock bug. And so they gave it that name and they had a website for it and everything. But
is this like a marketing company for good or something? Is this a particular marketing company?
No, so some of these like Heartbleed had a little bit of money behind them because some company was like, listen, we gotta fix this.
Mm-hmm.
The shell shock one, I don't think had as much money behind it. But anyway, this article is just kind of an interesting read of kind of an exploration of that space and who actually does that, you know?
Like, okay.
It's not just something that just appears.
You've sufficiently intrigued me. I want to find out more.
I didn't give any thought to it when heartbleed.org or whatever.
Yeah, no, it's like it's called Heartbleed, and that's what it's called.
Yeah.
That's interesting. Huh. So you're going to link to that article also at our website?
That's up at geekspeak.org.
Geekspeak.org. Stay tuned for that. Just really quickly, BuzzFeed's been doing some research. We all assume that internet culture means like cat videos and I can have cheeseburger and all that
like
stuff.
Yeah, that's like 80% of the internet, right?
Well, that's what I thought, yeah. As it turns out, that's what it is for America. BuzzFeed is finding that some of their articles don't translate as well, say, in France as they do in America. They don't get nearly the same amount of clicks because people in different countries prefer to interact with their internet differently.
Why do the French not like cats?
Je ne sais pas. I don't know. They've got Henri, but apparently it doesn't really come from France. Anyway, you can find out more about it at geekspeak.org. You've been listening to Geekspeak on November 29th. I'm Bonnie Jean Primps with Ben Jaffe. Thanks to Miles Elam for helping us prepare for this show. We are a service mark of David Lawrence, Geekspeak is, and is used with permission, and Geekspeak is Creative Commons Attribution 3.0, which we talked about earlier.